Then at 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Flashpoints at 10:15 with Dennis Bernstein. Between the covers at 11, David Naiman welcomes Yuri Herrera and his novel Kingdom Cons, a powerful reflection on the relationship between art and violence. And at 11:30, it's Word and Pictures with a look at virtual reality and 3D comics. Hear how the immersive technology is transforming the world of animation and comics.
HeyBoo Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. First thing I wanted to do was double down on something that I just heard from Joanne right here on KBOO, talking about policemen and the risk of their job and whether they should be able to say that they fear for their lives and kill anyone they want. Let me tell you what the 10 deadliest jobs are. Deaths per 100,000. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, all right? The number one deadliest job in the top 10 is logging workers. That's 128.8 deaths per 100,000, which is awful. And tells me that logging workers need to get their unions together and make sure that number goes down. Fishers and related fishing workers are number two at 117 deaths per 100,000. Third on the list, the top 10 deadliest jobs, aircraft pilot and flight engineers. That's 53.4 per 100,000. Roofers at 40.5. That's pretty bad. I would say that need to have some better standards for roofers, need to have lanyards. Can say the same for fishers as well. Structural iron and steel workers die at a rate of 37 deaths per 100,000. That's number five on the 10 deadliest jobs. I'm telling you these deadliest jobs because I want you to understand where policemen fall in that. And I want you to ask yourself, do they have the right to say that they can kill someone just because they feel for their lives? They fear for their lives. Now, number six on that list, the top 10, is refuse and recyclable material collectors. In other words, garbage men, 27.1. Number seven, electrical power line installers and repairers, 23 deaths per 100,000, a pretty high price to pay to keep the power on. Drivers and sales workers and truck drivers die at a rate of 22.1 deaths per 100,000. That's the way it is on our roads. Number nine, farmers, ranchers, and other agricultural managers, 21.3 deaths per 100,000. And rounding it out with number 10, the 10th deadliest job per 100,000, construction laborers at 17.4. Now, you may have noticed something of that top 10 list. I was going to tell you where police officers fit on the top 10 list of the top 10 deadliest jobs. It's not there. Being a policeman, policewoman, is not one of the deadliest jobs. It's not one of the 10 deadliest jobs. Out of approximately 1 million police and law enforcement personnel, with 126 deaths per year, the death rate for police is 12.6 per 100,000, well below the lowest of the top 10 construction laborers at 17.4 per 100,000. So, fear for your life? I don't think so. No longer a viable excuse. While you're listening to Press Watch, I have a number of topics to bring up here, a number of headlines. And then I want to get to the question of womb transplant. Shall I have one? Oh yeah, womb transplants are a thing now. But let's get down to, I'll bring that up in a minute. First, let's get down to the headlines. Is resident Rump so incredibly corrupt that he can be taken down by a mendacious and hypocritical fear-mongering campaign? There are so many things that disgust me about resident Rump that I don't know where to start. Most of these things are open reasons why no one should have voted for him, whether in the primaries or the presidential election. Hold your nose for a moment, and I'll list a few. He's a walking warning against toxic masculinity, against hubris, narcissism, shallowness, venality, greed, cruelty, and bigotry. He has a well-known history of thuggish behavior, from refusing to pay his own workers to stiffing whole states after making false promises. His King Midas tastes are a permanent embarrassment and grist for stereotype mockery of Americans. His mind is clearly inadequate to the task of the presidency and is failing from dementia in any case. His policies are a clear and present danger to the survival of the USA and its citizens, and that's from his build-a-wall bigotry to his pointless bombardment of Syria and his threats against North Korea. He lies, he lies, he lies. But it's probably not true in any substantial way that his dalliance with the Russians stole the elections. The Republican Party did a fine job of that. Look it up on gregpalace.com. Continuing with the news about resident Rump, his son's email chain, which revealed Donald Rump Jr.'s enthusiasm for meeting with a woman he was told was a Russian government lawyer offering damaging information about Hillary Clinton, has been greeted as evidence of collusion between the Rump presidential campaign in Moscow. The greater significance of the emails, according to The Guardian in UK, what they indicate in terms of the scope of the potential collusion between the Rump campaign and Russia, especially where documented Russian tampering of the 2016 presidential election is concerned, is unclear. So unanswered questions remain in important areas. Again, I'm passing on the headline here. I think that what we should really focus on is what a disaster the man is as president. But this is the topic of the day, so on with the headlines. The meeting whose arrangement with the Russian lawyer, whose arrangement the emails chronicle, brought together Rump Jr. and the two other campaign aides, Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner, with Natalia Velesnitskaya, described in the emails as Russian government attorney, though she denies having worked for the Kremlin. Significantly, Velesnitskaya has not been linked to the hacking effort that stole emails from the Democratic National Committee and from Hillary Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta, nor has she been linked to the alleged targeting of certain U.S. districts with fake news or the attempted spoilage of voter rolls. And speaking for myself, again, the Republican Party is perfectly skilled and experienced at that sort of thing, and don't really need help from overseas. But anyway, in a recent piece for The Guardian, Moscow correspondent Sean Walker wrote that Velesnitskaya was either, quote, a well-networked insider relaying secret Kremlin information, or a chancellor who somehow managed to get into the room with three Trump advisors in the midst of the presidential campaign. The Rump Jr. emails emerged not from a leak by investigators, but from work by the New York Times reporters. It is unclear how the emails and the meeting that they document fit within the larger context of investigations into alleged collusion between the Rump campaign and Russia. These investigations proceed out of public view inside the Justice Department, spearheaded by Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the FBI, and inside Congress. The conclusion of those investigations may show that the Rump Jr. emails and meeting to be significant are merely a footnote. Did the meeting mean anything or form part of a broader pattern of connections? The Guardian asks. In related news, an article of impeachment against President Ronald Trump was officially introduced. Donald Trump was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday. And the Constitution does not provide for the removal of the president for impulsive, ignorant incompetence. That was a quote of the person who introduced the bill. It does provide for the removal of the president for high crimes and misdemeanors. Representative Brad Sherman of California was the author of that quote. The resolution is also backed by Representative Al Green, Democrat of Texas, and it specifically cites obstruction of justice by Trump as a potential high crime and misdemeanor that could be grounds for the president's removal from office. Now, quoting recent disclosures by Donald Trump Jr. indicate that Trump's campaign was eager to receive assistance from Russia, said Sherman in a statement announcing his decision, quoting, "It now seems likely that the president had something to hide when he tried to curtail the investigation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the wider Russia probe. I believe his conversations with and subsequent firing of FBI Director James Comey constitute obstruction of justice," end quote. Sherman acknowledged that the introduction on Wednesday, yesterday, is only the beginning of what should be a long and thoughtful process in Congress, but it's one, he said, was necessary to protect our country, this is a quote, "from abuse of power, obstruction of justice, and impulsive, ignorant incompetence," end quote. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, doing headlines here. And I'm going to ask you later to call in with your comments and questions about womb transplant. From Médecins Sans Frontières, an urgent scale-up of aid is needed in the northern district of Abs, the area worst affected by Yemen's cholera outbreak. The disease is spread by contaminated water, so water and sanitation activities are particularly vital to tackle the problem at its source. In Abs district, Gabriel Sanchez says, quote, "Our teams are seeing an extremely poor sanitation situation and insufficient access to clean drinking water." He says, "This is clearly a main factor in the spread of the current cholera outbreak. Water and sanitation was an issue even before the cholera outbreak, but it is especially concerning now. Either we act now or we face an even bigger humanitarian crisis in the weeks and months ahead." Abs and Hadja governorate first registered its cholera case in late March. Since then, the number of cholera cases has exploded, with Médecins Sans Frontières Cholera Treatment Center in Abs Town receiving as many as 462 patients in a single day, more than anywhere else in Yemen. Since cholera broke out in late March, Médecins Sans Frontières has doubled the scale of its emergency response in Abs District. The MSF teams in Abs have treated more than 12,200 patients. That's just in that one town, with suspected cholera and acute watery diarrhea. This figure represents one-fifth of all cases seen by MSF's teams across nine Yemeni governorates, and nearly 5% of all cases registered across Yemen, according to the World Health Organization. After 2 months of exponential growth, the weekly number of cholera cases dropped for the first time in early July, but people with the disease are still arriving for treatment in their hundreds. Even before the cholera outbreak, MSF, that's Médecins Sans Frontières, teams in Rural Hospital were seeing substantial increases in emergency consultations, pediatric admissions, and surgical interventions. There have also been outbreaks of measles and whooping cough and peaks of malaria, all diseases that should be either limited or controlled together. These are a clear sign that Yemen's health system, desperately short of resources and staff, has collapsed. And now, speaking for myself, and of course, what Médecins Sans Frontières does not say, because they are a medical organization, they provide relief, they help, they stay out of politics. What they do not say is that all of these people have been miserably watching their children poop themselves to death because you and I have utterly failed to stop the use of our tax dollars to blast apart what little water and sewer system they had in that extremely poor country. The Pentagon and its corporate war ammunition suppliers and its redneck henchmen are cowardly guilty of crimes against humanity. When will it stop? The next person who describes the American war machine to me as the Defense Department is going to be deafened by my screams. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Body cam footage from the Orlando Police Department. Let's turn to imperialism at home, shall we? The White Terror Report shows two police officers pulling over Florida's only black state attorney, Aramis Ayala. One officer claims they made the stop because the tint on her car's windows was too dark. This is from TheRoot.com. They write, in a video released by the Daily Mail, the officer examined her driver's license and struggled to explain why he pulled Ayala over, saying, thank you, your tag didn't come back. Never seen that before, but we're good now. We ran the tag. I've never seen it before with a Florida tag. It didn't come to anything, so that's the reason for the stop, end quote. Ayala asked the officers to explain why they ran her tags. One officer then stated, quote, oh, we run tags through all the time, whether it's traffic light and that sort of stuff. That's how we figure out if cars are stolen and that sort of thing. Also, the windows are really dark. I don't have a tint measure, but that's another reason for the stop, end quote. And the accompanying photograph shows that the car windows are quite clear. Here's a quote from an email from colorofchange.org. Describing their online petition, they want to encourage all national district attorney members who are having a convention this week to end the practice of direct file, which automatically places juveniles in adult courts. They want all national district attorney association members to commit to considering immigration consequences for defendants as part of determining what to charge and not prosecute immigrants for minor offenses. They want to advise members to commit to using independent prosecutors to investigate cases of police brutality. All NDAA members, they write, should support an end to money bail and use a risk assessment system to determine when someone needs to be incarcerated. Also on the petition, all NDAA members should develop a restorative justice program in their county, which will serve as an alternative to incarceration, including for those people that commit violent offenses. Prosecutors have one of the most powerful positions in the criminal justice system, they write, yet 85% of them run unopposed. Aside from having control over the decisions that can make or break someone's life, they have executive power over the hundreds of staff and prosecutors running cases in our city and county courts. They have deeply coordinated relationships with the police, judges, and have a big influence on legislation, especially in the Trump era, when we're seeing a resurgence of racially coded law and order tactics and violent persecution of immigrant families. The choices district attorneys make are even more important. They write, we need to more than talk about progressive policies. We need real concrete plans and commitments to stop putting so many black and brown people in cages, because the persistence of crime in the most heavily policed areas tells us one thing: criminalizing the most vulnerable of us doesn't keep us safe. Now, if you are white like me, there's something you can do, especially if you're a college-educated white. Use your whiteness. You can do this about racially charged prosecutions. Answer your jury's summons. Get on the jury. Be as bland as you can, and then use the principles of jury nullification. I'm not going to go into detail about that right now, so I ask you to look that up on a search engine. Jury nullification. Jury nullification. Jury nullification. This is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Alex Emmons, writing in The Intercept, says last weekend the government of Canada did something its U.S. counterpart never has. As a part of a legal settlement, Canada agreed to pay $10 million in damages to a former Guantanamo detainee and U.S. torture victim. 7 years after a Canadian Supreme Court ruled that a citizen's right had been violated by his own government because of the detention and alleged torture in U.S. custody, former Guantanamo detainee Omar Khadr saddled a lawsuit with the government for an apology and millions of dollars. Laura Pitter, Senior National Security Council for Human Rights Watch, said Canada should be commended, this is a quote, for taking the step. Unfortunately, she said, the U.S. government, most responsible for Khadr's mistreatment, has failed to fulfill its obligation to provide compensation and redress, not just in Khadr's case, but in the case of scores of other men wrongfully detained and tortured in U.S. custody. In 2015, after spending a decade in Guantanamo, and 3 years in a maximum security prison in Ontario, the Canadian government released 28-year-old Khadr on bail. Khadr was only 15 in 2002 when he was captured and accused of trying to defend his country from invasion by throwing a grenade that killed an American soldier during a firefight at a suspected Al-Qaeda compound. He became the youngest prisoner ever held at Guantanamo Bay. Instead of treating Khadr like a child soldier and demanding his rehabilitation, the Canadian government sent intelligence agents to interrogate him. According to court affidavits, Khadr told visiting Canadian officials that he had confessed under torture. He claims to have shown them his injuries, but the officials refused to help. The details of Khadr's decade-long legal battle are complicated, but the result is simple. Khadr, now 30 years old and released on bail, settled a lawsuit against the Canadian government for $10 million and an apology. And of course, this is one of the people who was brought in under a $1,000 reward. And many of the people who were brought in and tortured at Guantanamo, perhaps most, were people who had nothing to do with fighting and simply provided a cash cow for their less scrupulous fellow citizens who wanted to get that $10,000 because there's a hell, or not $10,000, but $1,000 because there's a hell of a lot that you can do with $1,000 in Afghanistan. From Radio Havana, Dateline Brasilia, Brazilian prosecutor Sergio Zweiter has asked a committee of Brazil's lower house to accept the corruption charges against Michael Temer and move towards a trial. The prosecutor for the corruption case against the Brazilian president, Michael Temer, says there is sufficient evidence to warrant confirming the charges and proceeding to trial. If that happens, President Temer will have to step aside for up to 180 days until a verdict is reached. There were angry scenes just before the court's opening session as some of the political parties supporting the government changed their members on the committee, fearing they might not vote in favor of Temer. One of the lawmakers who was removed, Delegado Baldir, shouted, "Cowards, this government is a bunch of bandits." Brazil's Attorney General Rodrigo Janot requested last month that charges of corruption be brought against President Temer. A few days earlier, the federal police had confirmed the authenticity of an audio recording made in March as part of a plea bargain. In the recorded conversation with Wesley Batista, the head of the JBS meatpacking firm, President Temer was heard apparently approving the payment of bribes to Eduardo Acuna, the imprisoned former Speaker of Congress, to ensure his silence over the involvement of other government figures. In a series of corruption scandals, President Temer's popularity has plummeted to 3% or less. He's down there with gonorrhea as corruption accusations against him and other politicians deepen. Where were you when the Larsen C broke off? That might be a question that's asked in regard to climate change in the coming years. This is from KBOO. Yesterday, the Larsen C ice shelf in Antarctica released a trillion-ton iceberg, four times the city of London, 600 feet thick, and one of the largest ice islands ever recorded. A scientist with the National Snow and Ice Center was quoted on NBC News saying that the calving event, which created it, was suspicious. He said that it was an example of how massive changes could occur suddenly, and that scientists will be watching the ice shelf carefully now to see if there are subsequent changes to the speed of ice flow into the ocean. Other scientists have predicted that the loss of Larsen C's shelf will mean that the ice will begin to flow rapidly out of the bowl-like terrain that was formerly held fast by the giant ice shelf. The release of the iceberg does not mean that sea levels will rise, as the ice was already floating, but its removal will likely cause ice that is now land-based to flow into the ocean, raising water levels worldwide. As the maximum height physically possible for ice floating in the ocean is 600 feet, the Larsen Glacier may now begin to flow over the tip of the lip at a rapid pace and collapse into the sea. The new ice island is now likely to follow other icebergs into the sea near Antarctica, between Antarctica and Australia, presenting a hazard to navigation and altering the immediate environment. Now, this is being covered in the mainstream press and the corporate media, but it's being covered in a way that de-emphasizes the significance. One of the first things that you read in many articles covering the breaking off of Larsen C is that it is not even the 10th largest iceberg ever, although it is amongst the largest, to be sure, and that it does not raise the water levels, and this is very true. But the most significant thing, really the only significant thing in terms of international attention for the break-off of the Larsen C, is that it follows the break-off of Larsen A and B. In other words, it is a substantial portion of the entire ice shelf, and it alters the shoreline visibly even on a map of Antarctica. This is a huge amount of ice. It moves out of the way of an ice shelf that is under pressure. This bowl of ice, this subcontinent-sized bowl of ice, had a certain stasis and moved at a certain speed, very slow speed, a glacial speed, you could say, because that ice shelf was there floating on the water, holding it in place, and now circumstances have undermined the ice, and this is broken off. So now what is likely to happen is that titanic amount of ice will begin to flow more and more rapidly into the sea. This is the significant part. Not what just happened, but what it means will shortly happen. That ice will now flow from the land in Antarctica into the sea. So when you read articles that effectively poo-poo the significance of Larson C breaking off, you're being ill-served. From WBUR Boston, Massachusetts voters in 2018 will be asked whether the state will keep or repeal the new state law aimed at preventing discrimination against transgender individuals in public accommodations, as activists submitted enough signatures to secure a place on the ballot. That's according to the Secretary of State in Massachusetts. They said that of Tuesday this week. The ballot question committee, Keep Massachusetts Safe, filed 34,000 and change certified signatures with Secretary of State William Galvin's office, more than the 32,000 needed to ensure ballot access in 2018. According to that office, the committee has said hundreds of volunteers resisting radical transgender policies had collected more than 50,000 total signatures over the past 2 months in order to get a question on the ballot. The question on the ballot. Quoting, "We are extremely grateful to the thousands of people who courageously signed the petition at times in the face of threats and intimidation as voters began to learn about the full impact of the law. We saw them often move from alarm to action." That's according to Keep Massachusetts Safe. Safe from transgender people is what they mean. They said, "We look forward to spending the next 2 years continuing to raise awareness about the dangers of this law and making sure voters are fully educated on what is at stake," end quote. Supporters of the new law this summer hailed it as a long overdue protection of transgender individuals. The legislation allows transgender people to access sex-segregated locker rooms and bathrooms based on their gender identity rather than their anatomical sex. It bans discrimination against transgender people in public accommodations such as pools and restaurants. Quoting Casey Siffredini and Mason Dunn, co-chairs of Freedom Massachusetts, in a statement, quote, "Legislators updated our Commonwealth's civil rights law this year to legally protect transgender people from discrimination with the overwhelming support of thousands of businesses, faith leaders, women's advocacies, and anti-violence groups and fair-minded residents across the state," end quote. They said, "The people of the Commonwealth have a deep and long history of promoting fairness and inclusion. When presented with the question of whether to continue to treat transgender people as equal members of the Commonwealth in 2018, they will vote yes," end quote. And, of course, that comes in the context of the failure and attempt to repeal Washington's transgender protections just in the last week or so. Meanwhile, this from BuzzFeed, the Trump administration has appointed an activist who led a campaign to restrict bathroom access for transgender students to the Office of Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment in the U.S. Agency for International Development. So, high office for an anti-trans bigot. And continuing with the article, Bethany Cosma's title is Senior Advisor for Women's Empowerment. According to an agency spokesperson, Cosma did not return a message seeking comment for the story to BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed writes, Cosma held positions in the White House and Department of Homeland Security under President George W. Bush. According to her LinkedIn profile, before dedicating herself full-time to raising her children, in 2016, she launched a campaign to oppose the Obama administration's guidance to public schools that said transgender students have the right to use facilities matching their gender identity. The guidance was withdrawn by the Trump administration in February. USAID has backed programs in several countries with the goal of supporting LGBT economic empowerment, access to housing and health care, and political participation. So this would be a reversal for them. And they also write, the agency adopted guidelines in 2016 barring contractors overseas from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity and providing services. When asked whether Cosma's appointment signaled change in policy, the agency spokesperson responded, quote, USAID has not taken any measures regarding the discrimination policy for contractors, as is the case with many other policies. USAID is committed to promoting a work environment that is free from sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination in accordance with existing federal law, end quote. So in other words, didn't really answer that. pardon me. Skipping ahead in the article, quoting, Austin Ruse of the Center for Family and Human Rights, which opposes promoting LGBT and abortion rights in foreign policy, said he did not think that the appointment represented a reversal from Obama administration policy. He says the LGBTs are ruthless street fighters, end quote. And he cited efforts to discredit his organization as a hate group after it was included in a delegation to the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. He said, this administration is no slam dunk for people like me or Bethany Cosma. The Trump administration is filled with squishes on this issue. Bethany Cosman is a lovely, sweet woman who just happens to believe that girls with penises just ought not to be showering next to girls without penises. And July 2016, they write, Cosma published a post at the Daily Signal, publication of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank calling for a national campaign in opposition to the Obama administration's guidance saying transgender individuals have the right to use bathrooms matching their gender identity. She called the campaign United We Stand and made her case against the policy by repeating the unsubstantiated assertion that policies allowing transgender people to access the bathroom matching their gender identity leads to sexual assault. Quoting, to put it simply, a boy claiming gender confusion must now be allowed in the same shower, bathroom, or locker room with my daughter under the president's transgender policies. When I learned that predators could abuse these new policies to hurt children in school lockers, shelters, pool showers, or other vulnerable public places like remote bathrooms in national parks, I realized I had to do something, end quote. After President Donald Trump withdrew the guidance in February, Cosma wrote, the silent majority must no longer be silent. With Trump, we now have a president who is focused on remedying the lawlessness of the prior administration. So in case you don't know, I am transgender and an advocate for transgender rights. And I have a lot to say about that, and I'm interested in what you have to say about the situation. Have an article about the left's transgender problem. But before I get into that, I'm going to read this article from Scientific American by Fiona Ortiz, a 26-year-old trans woman who received the first transplanted uterus in the United States, said on Monday she was looking forward to getting pregnant next year. Quoting, she said she was told at 16 she would never have children. From that moment on, I prayed that God would allow me the opportunity to experience pregnancy. Said Lindsay, who did not give her last name to protect the privacy of her three adopted sons. Lindsay, who was born transgender without a uterus and received a womb from a deceased donor in her 30s, read a brief statement to reporters at a news conference. She was in a wheelchair and is staying at the hospital for monitoring. The transplant done in a 9-hour surgery on February 24th was the first of 10 uterine transplants planned as part of clinical trial at Cleveland Clinic, which has screened 250 potential recipients. The Cleveland team of surgeons who are conducting the trial said they work closely with doctors in Sweden, where five babies have been born since 2014 to mothers with transplanted wombs. Women who get a womb transplant in Cleveland will stay in the hospital 1 to 2 months following surgery, then return home and lead a fairly normal life on immunosuppression medications to keep their bodies from rejecting the transplanted organ. Lindsay must wait a year to get pregnant until she is on a lower dose of anti-rejection drugs. According to the doctors, after 1 or 2 babies, the uterus will be removed so that she does not have to spend her whole life on anti-rejection drugs. Embryos from donor eggs and her husband's sperm will be implanted in her uterus. She cannot conceive through intercourse because the uterine transplant does not include the fallopian tubes. The baby will be delivered by cesarean section as close as possible to its due date, the doctors said. Quoting obstetrics and gynecology surgeon Rebecca Flicht, referring to the year-long wait before trying to get pregnant, uterus transplant, she said, is not just about a surgery and moving a uterus from here to there. It's about having a healthy baby, and that goal is still a couple of years away. The women who participate in the trial include trans women who are born apparently male, cis women born without a uterus, which happens to 1 in 5,000 cis women, and others who have had a hysterectomy due to cancer or other problems. So the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Should I get, I can see a path using my connections and the resources I'm able to get. Should I get a womb transplant? Should I have a baby, and what should I name the baby? Should I have twins? 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187 on womb transplants for transgender women. Quoting an article from theestablishment.co, from moderate liberals' self-centered tantrums to the far-left radicals' conspiracy theories, it's impossible to deny that the left has a transphobia problem. The writer says, even though I've been an out trans woman since 2015 and knew I was queer ages before, this year marked the first time I attended a pride parade. She says, checking my usual cynicism at the door, I went all in, marching exuberantly with my partner and her wife at the Equality New York contingent behind New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Everyone should experience the joyful pride at least once, I figured. She writes, my partner agreed, heartily rollerblading the entire parade route on less than 4 hours of sleep. She writes, much of my marching time was spent exhorting bystanders to cheer for trans rights. As we passed the iconic Stonewall Inn, I turned once again to the right and screamed, if you have rights because of trans women of color, make some effing noise. Hoots and cheers ensued, and we proceeded on our way. She writes, little did I know that less than 2 hours later, when No Justice, No Pride activists blocked the tail end of the pride to call attention to violence against trans women of color, deportations, and the ongoing corporatization of pride, 12 of them would be arrested by the NYPD. As those same pride bystanders standing outside the bar where black trans activist Marshall P. Johnson, the saint of Christopher Street, resisted arrest and started a riot that would change the world, as they watched the arrest, they cheered again, not for the protesters, but for the police. Judging from the photos, at least one of those arrested was a trans feminine person of color. The message, though unintentional, was clear. The cisgender left, those who claim to support trans people in our struggle for civil rights and who make up the vast majority of those at NYC Pride, are quick to cheer our oppressors when that support becomes inconvenient. Bystanders are happy to acknowledge Pride's social political roots as long as that acknowledgement was brief and didn't get in the way of celebrating. As soon as political statements became an inconvenience, their support was swiftly withdrawn. Similar protests took place at other Pride events. D.C. attendees were quoted in the Washington Post yelling, shame, and you're going to ruin the parade, to No Justice, No Pride activists. Now, this is a quote of a New York trans activist. Doesn't directly reflect my thoughts, although it does raise the question, I would like to also raise the question, how much of the left is down for transgender rights? I think that I live in a bubble because I come and go at KBOO, and this is, well, this would not be described, this person writing this would not be writing this would not be describing that sort of situation if they were from KBOO, or am I wrong about that? But I have had fantastic support here, and since I first came out on the air in 2001, this has been a place, I guess this is the place I can go besides my own home, where I truly feel safe, and truly feel that I'm part of the community. So the number to call, 503-231-8187. And the question, should I get a uterus transplant? And what do you think of the woman who is getting a uterus transplant? 503-231-8187. And Dave is on the air. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
Wow, that was fast. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Do well. Thank you.
I've been listening to everything you've been saying, and I just wanted to change the subject just a tiny bit. I want to talk about systemic racism.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, so I bring up this. I thought this was going to be a bomb, right? I bring up transplanting uteruses for trans women in the context of people who want to roll back trans women even being allowed to get into a bathroom, and you want to change it to race. Well, race is very relevant, so I'm not going to stop you. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it has to do with systemic racism. It really does, because, you know, I'm going to let you go ahead and talk about transgender issues. I'll talk about this later.
Well, that's kind. Okay.
I'm so sorry. Thank you so much. I love you so much.
Well, thanks for calling in. Okay, the number to call, 503-231-8187. And I did want to talk about trans issues. I think that's something that I put off a lot. And, I transitioned in 2001, male, female, and have felt that I have always been in some way female, and have expressed myself as female all these years. I had a gender confirmation operation last year. I had been on testosterone suppressors for many years, they started making me sick. In 07, I did not have access to healthcare. I didn't have access to transgender healthcare in full. My employer and Kaiser Permanente were denying, and before that, Blue Cross, were denying access to transgender surgery, to confirmation surgery. So I had to take testosterone blockers, which began to make me very, very sick, which began to threaten my life. And so I asked them if they would consider removing my testicles so that I would not have the testosterone and not have to take the blockers. And they said no. So I was faced in 07 with the choice of either stopping the blockers and returning to my hirsute self and reversing the hormone-induced changes in my body, or doing something about it myself. And I actually ligated my own male organs and cut them off with a meat shears. And so when I had confirmation surgery, that was vaginoplasty, in other words, to install a vagina. And now the question, now that science has moved forward rapidly, much more rapidly than I would have guessed even last year, I had no idea. It turns out that all of this progress has been made, and it is now possible to transplant a uterus with the idea of having a baby for women like myself who do not have a uterus. And of course, that would require then in vitro fertilization, and it is possible to give birth. And so my question, what I brought up, is how do you feel about that? What does that bring up philosophically? What sort of social networks need to be created? What sort of social understanding needs to be created now that this is going to be happening? Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Joe's on the air.
Hello, Teresa. This is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, I think that if my approach or my attitude here is that I'd be supportive of it. I don't see really a issue in my heart and mind if someone chose to go that route. And I guess I would summarize it up. I don't know how else to say it. But yeah, I'd be supportive of it. If you yourself wanted one, then I would be completely supportive of it.
Well, that's amazing, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to reveal now that I've been putting forward a tease. I actually wanted people to talk about this. This actually is possible and is happening. I am actually not considering it. I was just kidding about that. I'm almost 60, and I don't think I would put myself through that.
Okay.
And I altered the article about the womb transplant to put in the part about the trans woman. It actually hasn't been done with a trans woman, but there is nothing scientifically to keep it from being done with a trans woman. I said it that way just for the sake of polemics, to get some calls in, to see what emotions I could arouse, because I know that there are contingents of people, I read about them every day, they're active. I just read some of the activity of a couple of them, who are going around saying that trans women are not women, and it seems to me that they are going to have to take an interesting position once a woman gives birth from her uterus. How can they then say that she's not a woman? And what is gender anyway, if we can alter ourselves in this way and experience life in this way? So I appreciate your call. Go ahead.
I have a question about that. When we transplant other organs that are needed, do we transplant from assigned gender to assigned gender? Like, do we take corneas from a man and say, oh, they're only from a man, they have to go in a man only, or they can go into a woman, or a heart? I don't know about that. I mean, I'm just wondering about that, because no one makes a big deal about that.
Yeah.
And especially, I mean, people who may have been affected from birth with defective organs and things like that, that they would then get a transplant from another gender. You know, what would be the argument there? One other thing is that I would want us to think about is that I see a lot of people my age. I'm in my mid-40s, mid to late 40s, and I see a lot of people my age who I would consider to be politically open-minded, who have bitter feelings about younger generations, the so-called Generation X versus the hipster, the baby boomers versus Generation X or whatever, or versus millennials. The thing to me is that if we open our eyes and our hearts to other generations, stop practicing ageism, we can come up with much more diverse opinions and understand other people. And, you know, I've heard people say, if you fear someone who has a religion different from yours, befriend them. I think it was Greg Steeves, actually, who said that. And, in the same token, I think if we have fears about younger generations, befriend them. And then that way you can understand how people raised in different circumstances think. And it's led me to become, I think, even more open-minded about things in life.
Okay, well, thank you for those comments.
Well, anyway, thank you again, Teresa. I'm glad I could actually catch your program. I have the day off today, so I'm listening to it. It's a great pleasure.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And what I've done is I've brought up, by using a ruse, by altering a few words in an article from Scientific American, I was pretending that uterus had been transplanted to a trans woman. Actually, this has not yet been done to my knowledge. But I see that it is inevitable. And it will fall under the category, of course, of fertility enhancement, which people pay for all the time, and people go through two great lengths. And these uteruses that I've referred to that have actually been transplanted, will be 10 of them will happen in the United States. One has already happened. And I think 5 of them have been transplanted in Sweden. Let me see if I can find the details on that. Let's see. Yeah, a Cleveland team of surgeons want to implant 10 uteruses. But in Sweden, 5 babies have been born since 2014 to mothers with transplanted wombs. And so this, of course, can be done with trans women as well. And I'm bringing this up because I want to ask you, as we see the rage against trans women, what is gender anyway? What is femininity? There's this, you know, the great elephant in the room is the idea that femininity is not as good as masculinity, and that when it comes to male to female transgenderism, traditionally, psychiatrists who are going through the Harry Benjamin standards, psychological workers, have checked to see whether male to female transgender people are so depressed that they are actually hurting themselves by considering that they are considering transition in order to hurt themselves. I'm not saying that that's, I don't know how accurate that approach is or how common it is. It's the other way when women are considering, when trans men are considering transitioning from female to male, they tend to get asked either directly or by implication, have they become manic? Are they power mad? And what that reveals, of course, is the power relations between masculinity and femininity between men and women. And the question of transplant of a uterus makes me think that it just brings the whole question of what is gender and what is femininity, what is a woman, and what is a man. All of that is brought up even more sharply into question by that, and so I'm very curious as to what you have to say about it. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and Brian's on the air.
Hello. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
I just wanted to call and just thank you so much for sharing some of your personal details about your journey. I am a practicing Catholic, and the people that I often am around, my community, are often extremely dismissive of transgender issues. And I just think that someone being willing to share, you know, the nitty-gritty details of your story, it makes it impossible to dismiss. And so I just wanted to thank you for that. And also on your point that you were saying about what is a woman, I think maybe part of what makes people, uncomfortable with transgender issues is why would you want to be a woman in this such, you know, masculine first society? And I think that if we understand that women are so powerful and women are so beautiful, maybe that's a threatening idea in and of itself.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. Any further thoughts?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling in.
Bye.
So we've come around to, and that was what I was getting at, this furor over, the furor that is caused by very conservative people who wish to exclude transgender people from public life by the ruse of preventing the use of bathrooms and by pretending, even though there's never even though this just is in the category of flat earth and moon made of green cheese stuff, pretending that there is a problem with predators and rapists dressing up as women and going into women's bathrooms, taking advantage of their little girls who they need to save from monsters like me. Of course, it's offensive to me, but it's also, it points to what people think masculinity is. It also brings up toxic masculinity. And with Resident Rump in office, this is the era of the backlash of toxic masculinity. And I think that we see, and if you look back as far as Gamergate, we can see this sort of thing coming. We can see that people who embrace toxic masculinity very much want it to be accepted once again as normal and necessary, and as part of a sort of, you know, don't get mad at me for saying this, part of a warrior mentality. Actually, I don't think that toxic masculinity quite intersects with warrior mentality. I think that warrior mentality is warrior mentality, and masculinity is masculinity. And toxic masculinity, well, is that me first, do as I say, suffer from intimidation from my size and strength wielded inappropriately, sort of thing. And I think that toxic masculinity figures into the conservatives' fears about their bathrooms being invaded by people like me, who they assume, no matter what I do or how I change my body, are actually, you know, brimming reservoirs of toxic masculinity. This is an interesting interesting point in history. So I encourage your calls and questions about that. And the number to call, 503-231-8187. And so far, I seem to have a lot of male callers. I'd certainly be interested in getting some female callers. Want to know what you think. What is femininity? What is masculinity? And Bill's on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
I was going off on your initial topic with the uterus transplants, and it's more like the devil's in the details, and maybe you'll have some answers for me based upon your research. Well, one, if you're transplanting anything, then you're going to have to deal with having to have pharmaceuticals for immune suppression. So that causes all sorts of problems. It can open you up to cancer.
Well, the Scientific American article indicates that the women who have successfully done this are having the uteruses removed after 2 years because of that problem, because of not wanting these people to have to suffer immune suppression for more than a couple of years, but they have successfully given birth. This has happened in Sweden.
And I just think, you know, in the case of a man, a trans, that just the whole physiology, it would seem to me that you've already got a transplanted uterus, you're on immune suppression, which would make you more susceptible to infection from any surgery, because I would think you couldn't have a vaginal delivery. It's difficult enough for women.
No, it's C-section.
So it'd be a C-section, so now you're opened up to a surgery, which there's always a risk of infection, and you're already on immune suppression drugs. So I just think there's a lot of problems there. And then how those immune suppression drugs would affect the fetus.
Well,
those are three things.
Childbirth
I would be
kills women
about.
All the time, and the babies. According to, there's no indication in the article that the babies have been harmed by the immune suppression.
Okay. Well, those are just some questions that I think are, you know, at least something to be taken into consideration. And I think especially the immune suppression drugs, I know this was just one case, a woman that I knew from where I worked, her father had to have a heart transplant. And he got the heart transplant, and it just definitely did lift him up. It really changed him around, but it was for a very short time because then he got cancer, and that was the end of it. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that. You brought up some other interesting topics, but I'll just stick to the specifics of what you were initially talking about and let
somebody else
on the line.
All right,
thank you.
Thanks for that. All right, yes, I've been talking about, in the light of the fact that uteruses can now be transplanted, will be transplanted, will surely be transplanted to trans women, what is femininity? What is motherhood? I guess what I'm dancing around is, what is essentialism? Can we avoid being an essentialist? Can we say that gender is entirely a construct? And if we can, if gender is entirely a construct, then why not transplant uterus? I mean, because we go through these fertility enhancements procedures for cis women, why not for trans women? And I think that there are some young trans women who would greatly benefit from being mothers, and probably their future kids will benefit from the fact that their mothers have had this experience of being on both sides of the gender divide. I think it's a beautiful thing, and it's a beautiful piece of progress in medicine. And I wonder what you think about it. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Edie is on the air.
Hi, Teresa. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks.
You asked, do we think someone should have a surgical transplant of a uterus? And I'm saying that I do not have the medical, and I don't think any human being has the medical information. I certainly do not have the right or the moral authority or any credibility or earned trust to tell someone what they should or shouldn't do with his or her own body. And I do want to add some information for someone to consider deeply. Pregnancy, birth, recovery from C-section, breastfeeding or not, parenting is much more complex than can you biologically do it and do you want to do it. Children are not going to be what you want or expect. The experience is not going to be what you want. And what's most crucial is that one loves and accepts, respects and honors one's own self. And with that well of love and security and integrity can be there for the other and love them unconditionally and have the emotional resilience to deal with, you know, everything from different temperament, you know, hard to sleep child to severe medical consequences and poverty and abuse. You know, you don't know that your child's not going to be a psychopath and you have to love them anyway. You don't know that they're going to love you back. And so what pregnancy can do is prepare someone emotionally, morally, spiritually to surrender at when one's ego and will, but this, and develop a sense of inner trust and a bigger spiritual trust and community connectedness. At the same time, become, if one were cowardly and internalized a society's victimization, that one learns to question authority by having one's own internal authority. One becomes braver and stronger, willing to risk one's life for others. It's a change to get us out of the dominant culture's either or male, female, black, white, rich, you know, constructions. And if we make that moral change that pregnancy doesn't always result, we have a lot of bad, abusive parents, but that it's that change, transformation of one's character, one's worldview, one's communicating with people, and one's life purpose that is really what I think is more important in deciding whether or not to risk pregnancy or parenting. And that's what we need in a time when we have too many unwanted, unloved, unsupported children and mothers. And we need that first. And there's so much work that we as a society can do to support each other, because it doesn't matter how knowledgeable or skilled you are, if you're houseless, if you're impoverished, if you're abused, it's harder to give your skill and knowledge and heart to the children that need it in a harder and harder environment, socially and materially. And that's what I want.
As a parent myself, I can certainly agree with much of what you're saying there. I'm not inclined to do it because of my age, but I think, you know, I might change my mind if I have been getting stronger and stronger. Are you getting around to saying that trans women should adopt?
No. Okay. I'm saying that whether one is cis or trans or has both genders from birth or whatever, that regardless of the physiology, that one must look at the psychology, the morality and spirituality, and community supporting each other. And
we certainly need more of that.
And that's what I want us to consider more deeply.
Well, what a wonderful call to wrap up.
I want something. I'm going to get something.
What a wonderful call to wrap up with. Although I would say that my desire is just as important as a cis woman's desire in that regard.
Of course.
Thank you very much for calling in. That's exactly the sort of call that I was hoping to get by bringing this topic up and by using the polemics of pretending that the trans woman uterus transplant had already been done. So thanks so much for calling in. All right, you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and Air Cascadia is coming up, and you've been listening to KBOO 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and to KBOO.fm, where you can donate by pulling it up and looking at what we would like to offer you as a member, KBOO.fm, which allows us through the World Wide Web to go out to all the ships at sea.
And good morning. It is KBOO Portland, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. At 10:15, join us for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, it's Between the Covers. Today, David Naiman welcomes Yuri Hreda and his novel Kingdom Cons, a powerful reflection on the relationship between art and violence. And then at 11:30, join us for Words and Pictures. Today, with a look at virtual reality and 3D comics. Hear how the immersive technology is transforming the world of animation and comics. That's coming up at 11:30 today. But stay with us. We've got Air Cascadia up next. It's headlines, interviews, and commentary right after this.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 37th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 14th, 15th, and 16th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting live on Saturday beginning at 2 p.m. with the Bylines Quartet starting at 2:30. Again, that's the 37th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, broadcasting on Saturday, July 15th from 2 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.